good morning, or afternoon, or evening, depending on what time of day you're listening to this fabulous non-pro podcast series. We welcome you to the first episode of Last Week in Geek, where we discuss the importance of some very distinct, and some might say historical, pop culture fandoms. So this is Michelle, and I am joined here by...
Pope.
Al.
James.
Pete.
So for those who don't know, last week, Wednesday, July 31st, was none other than Harry James Potter's birthday. So we are going to be diving into some very thought-provoking but probably nonsensical discussion about the Harry Potter fandom and how did they do it? How did this fandom work? I feel like, am I joined with everyone in the room who has very much in-depth knowledge of the Harry Potter series?
No.
Are there any novices here?
Oh, absolutely, right here.
Al's the movies only sort
ooh,
of fan.
Ooh, I hurt for your soul.
Yep.
I have all the books on tape if you want.
No, I have all the books, actually, in hardcover. I've just never actually gotten around to reading more than two of them.
Oh, the books on
Which
tape
two?
Are great, though.
The first two.
Yeah, I have the Stephen Fry version. It's amazing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know you had the Stephen Fry version. Okay, we're going to talk, Pope. We're going to start with kind of our first experience into the fandom. What was it that made you interested in the Harry Potter series? Whether it be starting with the books, or starting with the movies, starting with a video game, whatever it is that really got you hooked into it. If it's all right with everyone, I'll start with my origin story.
You're our host. Go ahead.
Ooh, I feel so special. I've never hosted before. So, for me, the first Harry Potter book came out when I was around 7 years old, if I'm doing my math correctly. This is very much showing my youth in the room, so I feel like I'm very often one of the youngest and innocent people here. A seven-year-old doesn't really want to read this book that has no pictures in it, and starts off with a chapter about some man named Vernon Dursley going to the drill company he works at. So my sister, who's 3 years older than me, so at the time she was like 10 or 11. So, you know, 11 years old is probably the best year of your life to start reading the Harry Potter series, since it starts off with an 11-year-old boy. I didn't want anything to do with it. My sister locked me in our parents' bedroom, forced me to sit on the floor, and force read the first chapter of the book to me, and I hated her for it. I was just like, I don't like this. I want to read my picture book with sharks in it. I don't know why you're doing this to me. So, like, fast forward maybe like a year and a half, and I'm through all three books waiting for the fourth one to come out.
So really,
and
it was
never
off.
Really.
So it was a slippery slope from
oh,
there.
It was a very slippery slope okay. from there, so...
Thought it was like fast forward 3 years, and I still hadn't touched the second chapter.
No, it did. I remember, though, I really forced myself to read that book, though, because it kind of got to a point where it's like, I need to just do this now to prove my sister wrong or something, because then she was like, oh, well, you're just stupid because you don't want to read this.
Reading out of spite is the best reading
really
for those for those of you who participated in book club.
My story's kind of similar to yours, though. My brother had I didn't pick up a book until it was between Prisoner and Goblet of Fire.
Mm-hmm.
So I hadn't touched a book until then. My brother had read the first three very avidly, loved them, stuff like that. And then I think also in that time period is when the first movie came out. And, you know, the trailers got me interested. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll read it. I read through up until like two chapters from the end because I didn't want to ruin the ending. Watch the movie, finish the books, and then from there it just like really exploded such to the point that when 7 came out, I read it in about 22 hours.
Me too! Oh my gosh, I started at midnight, I was done by like 10 o'clock the next night.
I would say I have a very unique and different experience than most people here. As when I was growing up, it was always sort of like this thing. Like, I remember specifically in middle school, like, it was this big thing that kept gaining traction. It was like, oh, everyone's reading the Harry Potter books. And I was like, that's cool and all. Like, yeah, cool. I didn't really want to do it because I was kind of like Michelle. I'm like, oh, I don't want to read a book without pictures in it, even though I have to for school. So I would just kind of like read whatever Scholastic book came in with my subscription like that month. So it was just kind of like, eh, all right, whatever. I don't really go out and search for reading materials on my own. And I don't remember really getting involved in it at all, despite my parents like wanting me to gain some semblance of popular culture and like telling me I should, and me just fighting them every step of the way.
And you never really did gain a semblance of popular culture. No.
No, I know I didn't actually. That never happened. Like,
at least you learned how to read.
Yeah, at least I learned how to read. That's very true. But it was when the movie started to come out, even then, that was when I started to get my chip on my shoulder about the series, because the movies start to come out around the same time as Lord of the Rings, and I was, like, really into Lord of the Rings, like, obsessively, and I felt like, come on, guys, stop stealing the thunder here, like Peter Jackson's magnum opus is coming out. Like, let's respect this a little bit. Hold off on the fantasy. They're like all these comparisons to Harry Potter, and I'm like, guys, they're just not the same thing. Like, yes, Miss Rowling has put out some fine books. They're okay, but Mr. Tolkien created a legacy. Let's give him his pace.
And to think that was a world where, like, you thought there was a limited quantity of fantasy that the zeitgeist
right?
could handle.
Exactly, yeah. Oh my god, I was proven wrong in so many ways.
You've never read the books, though?
Oh, no, I did, actually. It took till high school. I read the first two, and I loved them. I thought they were great. I never continued to read them, though, even though I have all of them in hardcover. I got them as a Christmas gift one year, because my parents really wanted me to read Harry Potter for some reason. And I just sat there, and like I went through the two books. I breezed through them, like, very, very quickly. Again, I was in high school at that point, so, like, you know, they're, you know, meant for... The first ones seem like they're for a much younger audience than they later become, if memory serves. But they were great, and I remember them really, really fondly, but I never went past that and never, like, picked them back up.
I'll summarize this story rather quickly. For those of you who were listening to our book club as well, the kind of a repeat... but basically, when I've always had trouble reading because of my dyslexia. So when I was younger, my mother started reading the books to me, which was great. It was a really awesome experience, and we read together up to the third one, Prisoner of Azkaban. And then the fourth one came out, and my mother had less time than I did, and that book was massive. And, you know, I wanted to get through it. You know, I wanted to get that story in fast. So, well, it wasn't the first book I read on my own. It's kind of one of, like, the biggest achieving moments in my reading. And after that, it was pretty much nonstop. I'd be like, oh, well, if I can get through this, you know, this huge thing, I can probably read anything. And then it was on to Lord of the Rings and Artemis Fowl and, you know, any other available good literature, kind of within that sci-fi fantasy zeitgeist, you know, as well as school reading.
Well, my experience diverges a bit from the rest of you because, I mean, when I was a kid, Harry Potter wasn't a thing. He didn't exist. I happened to be the same age as Harry Potter, though. We were both born in 1980.
Ah.
The first I encountered Harry Potter was, believe it or not, from an infographic in The Onion.
Really?
No. You know, the satirical
really?
Newspaper. Talking about why people were so into Harry Potter, why the world was so... At the time, the Harry Potter books occupied the top three spots in the New York Times bestseller mm-hmm. list. I was a fan. It included a whole list of reasons why people like it, including... combines the magic of Tolkien with not being long.
That didn't last.
No, it didn't. And recently realized Aslan, King of Narnia, is just a big preachy asshole.
Also truth.
And for people my age, jokes like, mistakenly thought books were about beloved MASH star Harry Morgan, who played Colonel Potter. yeah, so that was pretty much my only experience with Harry Potter for a while until the movie came out, the first movie came out. And I started watching the movies... And I enjoyed them and was slowly talked into reading the books, actually listening to the audiobooks by friends who said, oh, it's so much deeper. And it is, except for the first couple. I'd say arguably the first couple of books don't leave much out in the films.
Yeah, there's a few minor characters that don't make it and that become more relevant later on, but there's no way for them to know that at the time.
Why is there no Peeves?
Yeah, essentially. Like, that character, I think, eventually became rather important, but there was no way to know that when you first read those books.
He was like a critical hinge on a bunch of stuff that they kind of moved on to other characters. Yeah. They just didn't want to do CGI in some instances.
They did film him.
Yeah.
He was credited in everything, the actor that
they
had to...
He was Drop Dead Fred.
Yeah.
They said it just looked so bad that they're like, we cannot put Peeves in the movie.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't even think you... I've heard people like, oh, you can find deleted scenes and this and that. I've never seen anything about it, but Yeah. It was like, he got a credit in the first movie.
Knowing the actor who played him from his previous work, Drop Dead Fred, I can't imagine that being inserted into the movies. The it would just be so grating and annoying.
Probably.
Well, that was Peeves. He was grating and annoying.
I agree, but like it would have been in a really bad way.
There are some things that maybe work on the page that don't work as well on the screen.
And I think that's just what they ended up having to decide. Because I know there's one of the first scenes where the trio gets in trouble in the first book/movie is they're caught by Peeves while they're out with the getting rid of the dragon, Norbert, or whatever, and it's like, Ickle Kidsy's out of bed, or whatever it is he says, and it's just Neville that stumbles into them instead. So they just throw off miscellaneous characters who they just can't cast to more mainstream characters that are already there. Well, it's like, well, we know this person was supposed to do it in the book, but we can't do that. So, surprise, he's going to do it.
Yeah, in the movies, it's like definitely, I feel like from all the characters they knock out, you have a presence of Gryffindor and Slytherin, and the other two houses are like, there. But, like, Luna's the only one you get really from Ravenclaw, and nobody really is led to care from the movies about Hufflepuff.
What about that vampire?
The vampire was really, really important. He died in the fourth one.
Oh, Cedric. He was Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
Hufflepuff.
They're excellent
really...
finders.
Yeah, they're really good at finding cups that they shouldn't be touching.
It's like, I remember reading through, one of the memes, though, about it recently, where, like, you know, they put all the four houses where they're like, all right, cool. So the brave ones, we have four kinds of kid, right? Brave, evil, smart, and miscellaneous. And they're like, correct, go on. But they actually, like, at like several points in the book, that is what they say.
Yeah.
Like, it's like almost verbatim where they're like, all right, cool, we'll take all the brave ones. All right, cool, we'll take all the smart ones. We'll take all the ones who are
evil.
Not evil, more...
Ambitious.
Yeah, ambitious is what I was going for.
And what's her name? Euphigenia Hufflepuff or whatever.
She walks up and she's like, I'll take the rest of them.
Give me the leftovers.
Jeez. I got it. They're fine.
No, she just didn't care. She just loved everybody.
Bring me your tired. You're hungry.
Pretty much.
Especially you're hungry.
Your magical masses.
Yeah. You're yearning to be mediocre.
Right. Oh, man. Hufflepuffs just get such a bad rap.
But they also talk about the fact that they're upset about the mediocreness.
Can I ask a question?
All right.
Mm-hmm. We've all assumably taken the test. We're going to have a Harry Potter conversation. Shouldn't we say which house we land in on?
Sure. We can assume we've all taken this test.
I don't trust the test. I self-identify.
All right, Michelle, fine. How do you self-identify?
I self-identify as a Slytherin.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Sorting Hat takes your preference into account.
Exactly. Except not the one on Pottermore, because they put me in Gryffindor, and I was with Taylor at the time when we did it. And, like,
didn't she also get thrown in Gryffindor? And she's like, I'm a Hufflepuff.
Yeah, she got really mad about it, too, where I'm like, this test is a lie. Because the thing is like, they ask you questions where it's like, your friend is in trouble. Do you help them, or do you run away? And I'm like, well, I'm not going to run away. Slytherins aren't all evil.
Or
We've
cowards.
We've seen that. We're not cowards.
Yeah.
We're just very ambitious and cunning, and we care very much about ourselves, but that doesn't mean we don't care about other people.
We're not saying that you're all evil. I'm sure some of them are very fine people.
Not all Slytherins.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, God.
No, but, all right, anyway.
Pete, what about you?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm sure as hell not a Puckwudgie.
All right, then.
Ilvermorny. Crap. No, I'm a Ravenclaw.
I both self-identify and pretty much on every test, Gryffindor.
I don't know. I'm not as well versed enough to actually.
Al, you're a Hufflepuff.
Yeah. I think Puff is pretty accurate.
We'll decide.
I am an excellent finder. So and I do like drinking butter beer and lazing around and finding my way into the kitchen. So this feels right.
I've literally never taken a test, and I don't know how I'd place my personality. I used to be bookish when I was younger, so I guess I'd be a Ravenclaw.
I don't know. I think you're a Slytherin, too. Well, come to my side.
He could be. He's probably from Durmstrong.
Yeah, they don't have houses
That's
there.
The Russian one?
That's Bulgarian.
Oh, Bulgarian.
Yeah, come on. Russians are evil.
Bulgarians, though, are very nice.
No, they're just loaded. That's all.
Speaking of Bulgarian, that was one of the things. They were very, very keen on accuracy in the movies, so the Bulgarian people were all Bulgarian. They like wouldn't hire anything but British actors to be in the movie, except like Christopher Columbus, the director of the first two movies, like had his daughter as an extra once. And
no,
other than that, it was
extra.
Yeah, exactly.
They had plenty of extras that weren't.
No, they were all British.
The Huffs.
Cho Chang is Welsh. So.
All part of the Greater Kingdom.
I know, I'm kidding.
He runs like a Welshman.
So, it was Julianne Hough and her brother, Derek, right? They were in. They were extras. They were living in England at the time.
Oh, okay.
Well, they're English by citizenry?
No. They were just visiting.
Oh, never mind then, okay. No. I'm full of it. I don't know what I'm talking about.
So, what is it about the series and the whole fandom within the movies? You know, they make a theme park. There's two theme parks, actually.
Oof.
We have another movie franchise with Fantastic Beasts. We've got Cursed Child as the screenplay. We have Cursed Child as the Broadway play. How did this work? How did this, and outside of whatever the Onion article from 1999 said, why do we think this worked?
Part of me wants to believe it was just really good timing with marketing. Like, I feel like the books were coming out and gaining speed, and someone thought in some movie studio somewhere, wait, if we hop on this now before the series finishes, like, then we ride that gravy train, like, as far as we can. Like, this is going to be great. I feel like that wasn't really done before. I don't think that we've ever picked up a book series in the middle of its run to make a movie for it. Like, that, I don't think that ever happened.
I think that might be more of a symptom of it being popular than a cause.
Maybe, yeah, but I think it definitely...
I think it does feed into it.
Yeah, I think that was a big contributing factor because... Loop. Like, I, as a person who, like, really only learned about the thing from watching the films, like, and I didn't even watch them in theaters. Like, it took until, like, the very last film for me to actually go see a Potter film in theaters. But I still knew so much. I still gained so much. Became so much part of Zeitgeist because I would watch those movies. I'd watch them on Halloween or Christmas when, you know, ABC went to play them and whatnot.
That's also kind of weird, though, because we live in a world now where every franchise is just going and going and going. But... You know, when these movies started coming out, like, what did you have that went more than, like, three movies? There were, like, there's probably, like, four franchises before that.
And not even, really. There weren't many films that went
like
for three.
Alien, like, Rocky, Bond.
Rambo, maybe?
I mean, other than, you know...
No, not even
cheap, cheap 80s horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
But in a different... That kind of existed in a different sort of class.
Yeah, that was definitely not this sort of...
But I would argue that the success of... This didn't really rely on the movies. I think, in my mind, it's a combination of things. One, we love stuff that we can self-identify with, and those first three Harry Potter books just have a lot of space for you to identify in between the lines with a lot of those characters. And then I think, on a more adult angle, at the time, J.K. Rowling's story itself was intriguing. You know, we talk about, you know, the as the myth, the legend goes, you know, she kind of was scribbling out Harry Potter on napkins at the coffee shop, you know, when she was essentially broke and homeless, you know. And there's something to be said about people wanting to see success stories in both real life and in fiction, right? Harry as a character, well, he might be this chosen one, you know, it's still kind of a rags to riches story for him. He kind of gets what we all want. He gets to kind of have his cake and eat it too,
unless it gets dropped on Aunt Marge's head.
I'll also say, like, I think it came at one of the best times in our lives. I think that this was when Latchkey Kids were really at their height, and I think continued now, like, where not so much that everyone was feeling abandoned or that everyone felt like they were living with the Dursleys, but I think kids at this point in time, it was when both parents were heavily in the workplace, which I don't think was technically true of the generation beforehand, and you had a kid who was kind of growing up on his own, and I think a lot of kids identified with that, and I think really felt that pretty strongly, that, like, you know, mom and dad are there, kinda, as they are with Harry, kinda, you know, so, but it still was this, like, odd feeling of having to do things on your own, not parents aren't necessarily there or not as there as you want them to be because they both have jobs and they're both away and they have to spend time with themselves and balance that with you. And a lot of time you do get left with, you know, relatives that you're not as, you know, fond of or maybe are even mean. So I think it came out with that idea at like just the right time to hit all of those kids.
I think similar to that, there was, in the way Rowling crafted the stories, it was a timelessness to them.
Yeah.
You know, everything was brand new, but it was also at the same time familiar. You know, you had the story of the, you know, downtrodden young boy who yearned for a better life, which is, you know, a trope in so many things.
Yeah.
You know, you could compare Harry to Cosette in Les Miserables, if you want.
Yeah, or Luke Skywalker, yeah. King Arthur, any of the...
Exactly. And I think that gave people an in to the world. It made the world that she was creating feel comfortable. And the structure of the school being a larger environment that anybody... It was big enough that the reader could imagine themselves in there. You could imagine yourself getting that letter. Anybody could get that letter and go to Hogwarts. And it creates this dreamscape for you to insert yourself in.
But yeah. It's also a familiar, as you said, a familiar mm-hmm. environment you can automatically latch on to. Every kid goes to school, right?
Yeah.
Every kid has some sort of relationship to schooling and stuff like that. So the world being the school, essentially, right, for all but the last book, you know, really adds to that, you know, latchability. And I think it's proof that we see kids are still reading Harry Potter today. You know, our generation, as we're becoming adults, are, you know, at the right age introducing that book to, you know, keep them captivated. And I think, you know, it's the same way you've seen with books that hold on for a long time, right? Like Lord of the Rings or, you know, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
And I feel like there's definitely a moment where, you know, some kids go, oh, adults won't like it. You know, like you get those like fanatical people burning the books because it's about witches and wizards. And they're ugh. Like, that's how they know it's a good book and they want to pick it up and read it. A
little bit of controversy
all
never
hurt.
All
you need to do to make kids read a book is ban it.
Other big thing is we forget that this book series grew up with its audience. Like, not only did Harry grow up, but like everything sort of became like more mature as it went on. Like, this big, huge, awesome fantasy world slowly but surely started to reveal how much of it was actually not that great and how much of the real world was a heavy mm-hmm. influence on it. To the point, like, well, some of the politicians and so on were not, while on the good guy side, were not necessarily decent or good people.
I feel like one of the things that really sticks with the whole series is just a lot of the morals behind people's actions. I feel like people can really relate to that. There's been like studies that they say kids that grew up reading Harry Potter or that read Harry Potter at some point in their lives end up having better morals. It makes you a better person. But it really does display that good versus evil type of theme. But at the same time, you recognize that not everyone who's good does everything for the good best reasons, and not everyone that's evil ended up there by choice. So, because we see that with the more complex characters, like, you know, everyone thinks Snape is bad.
No, Snape is bad.
It's true. He didn't do anything good for good reasons, but he did still do things that were good.
Always.
So, and I feel like having those characters is just something that you weren't really seeing in what was, quote-unquote, a children's book.
Harry Potter transcends children's books. Because Rowling grew with her audience, mm-hmm. because the audience grew with the books, because her writing became more complex, because the stories became more complex, it became a unique journey. And as long as people continue to mimic that journey, I think you'll continue to see this, you know, this progress. And it's a really unique situation with a book series, right? I mean, how many other book series can you think of really work like that? You know, one of my favorite books is the Artemis Fowl series, but Ian Colliffe's writing stays really at a base level, you know? And Tolkien, you know, through the Lord of the Rings writes, like, at a high level here.
You can make the argument that he definitely starts somewhere with The Hobbit and then extends differently to Lord of the Rings, but it's such a jump. Like, it's so huge.
Yeah, it's why I sit in, like, not necessarily my favorite plot point, but, like, my favorite point in the whole series is when Cedric Diggory gets killed, and because really, everything just, like, really ramps up there. Everything, like, it is literally, like, the turning point of the series. Everything gets more, I don't want to say adult, but, like, definitely more serious. There's a real threat of, like, people actually dying, because from there, like, people you really care about start going.
Diggory was the first one, first character to die.
On page, pretty much.
Quirrell.
Yeah.
Quirrell
yeah.
is the first character to really die. But
it's a character you had a strong relationship with. Yes. Sure. The book intentionally builds the relationship with Cedric.
And Quirrell was kind of dead to begin with.
Yeah, it's like hit or miss. We're not really sure how that worked. I feel like with the pivot in book four, I feel like a lot happens as a 14-year-old that's just relatable. That's kind of, you know, prime adolescence of the, like, suddenly now everyone's angry and full of hormones and we have all caps Harry in book five. Which, granted, all caps Harry had a valid point of being all caps Harry, so.
Dumbledore took the blame for that at the end of that
book.
Yes,
he did.
It's very strange because I feel like, from a film perspective, not someone who read the books, the Cedric death does not hit very hard. I don't know what it is about that translation from book to film, but it's so, like, called a million miles away when you're watching the movie that it doesn't hit the way I think they wanted it to. And that's, I don't know how you would fix that.
Hey, don't you have a soul?
No, I do. Like,
No.
It hurts more in the book than the movie.
No, I don't doubt. I'm not saying that his death in the books is somehow bad. I'm just saying, like, in the film, it's different and therefore not as strong. Yeah.
I feel like the way the movie shows it is just so suddenly, well, Cedric said, all right, now let's move on to Harry Don't Die.
Yeah.
I have a similar ride with the movies in perspective. You know, I feel like as far as the films go, they range in tone and intent, obviously, because the films have different directors throughout the series. But I think a lot of credit, if we want to talk about the films, goes to, in my mind, I like Cuarón and I like Yates, right? So as fun as Christopher Columbus's first two movies are, they feel like, I kind of think, as Pete said, the book's on page, you know, which is fine, but it doesn't add a lot of self-identity to the film series to kind of branch off from its source material, which obviously needs to happen at some point, because as the books get larger, as more stuff happens, more adapting will be needed and less, you know, rote, right? And Alfonso Cuarón comes in the third book and, for better or for worse, goes hard on adaption, right? Really establishing a new tone and a new way of looking at the series that works and doesn't work in many different places.
As I've said many times, he's the director that bumped his head and thought he was Tim Burton. Like, essentially, because, like, that was, it was so jarring going,
singing toads.
It feels like Dumbledore is an entirely different person.
And it's crazy.
I mean, you say that like we're joking about the actor, but, like, he literally changed tone completely. Yeah. Like, well, where a lot of the stuff he does is, like, feels less calculated than the Dumbledore character, because he's very much like, I know 17 moves ahead and I'm going to control everything and I can half read everybody's mind a little bit. Mm. So, and then you get this, like, screaming, angry, kind of taken aback character that almost doesn't make sense by the guy you get in the books.
And then I feel like, as far as films, I like the fourth one, but I feel like it's a little bit of a fall off.
Yeah.
Cuarón's take was so drastically different that the studio wanted to go with a safer bet as far as director, so they cast someone who had less experience doing action and doing that sort of big movie set piece sort of thing. So, well, it works in a lot more of the personal moments in four. I think, in my mind, Al, is some credit to the Cedric Diggory death and stuff like that. It's just not framed in a way that doesn't work, but I feel like I take some issue with.
Yeah.
I think it's crazy, though, going through the film series also, like, they were so big and they couldn't cut anything out that they had to, you know, make seven books into eight movies.
But that was also partially, well, the gravy train's going to run out. Let's make this into two movies, because we then see that again with Hunger Games does the same thing where they split the last book into two parts.
But Harry Potter is the first one to do it.
That's true.
Yeah.
And that's the onboarding then of David Yates, the director who is still essentially the sole director of the Harry Potter series to date, or the Wizarding World universe to date. And David Yates comes in and takes a little bit of a different approach to the Harry Potter world. He kind of takes it back to basics and wants to really establish some texture to the world. The example I like to use is one of the first things David did on set was he brought in martial artists to train all of the people who were wizards to move their wands in particular ways to mimic different fighting styles, right? And that, you know, that was something that wasn't present in the series before, that sort of texture, right? It was just people kind of mashing their hands forward to go like, you know, like magic, 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 you know? But obviously there would be some sort of texture to that visual that was never addressed, you know, in this series going forward to that. And then Yates kind of carries that on to what we have today, good or bad.
Fun fact, that guy has, the martial arts guy has created a whole wand work class that you can take if you're really interested.
Well, he's cashing in.
Oh, yes, he is. It's very like, particular. I've heard people talk about they have it, like, during the special events in the Harry Potter world or whatever, where you can, learn how to, use your wand or whatever. I don't know how to phrase it, but yield your wand.
Wield.
There we go.
Yeah.
You know what I meant.
Brandish.
Is it weird, like, coming from, and I've said this many times, I really liked Columbus's take even before I had read the books at all, and I really felt like my favorite film still is probably Chamber of Secrets. And I like, not that I'm so against any other stuff, but I felt like, man, couldn't we have just kept up with what he was doing? Like, I don't know what that is. Like, again, coming from a guy who did not read the books, like, I am really curious, where the heck am I coming from on this?
I feel like we couldn't keep going with the very, as Pete said, page-to-screen type of, you know...
Adaptation
yeah. of it, just because I feel like the series gets past what Columbus could do with it. Because
Maybe.
It gets that different... even, the, like, reading the second book and reading the third book, J.K. Rowling's tone changes a lot, too, yeah. because now we suddenly have this already known threat in book three, whereas book two, we're like, oh, okay, like, well, we got past that crazy stuff of first year, guys. This year's gonna be fine. Oh, wait, we're crashing into a tree. A chamber is open. People are being petrified. Oh, God, oh, God.
Yeah, the drastic...
Hermione is missing for half of it.
The drastic tonal shift with Corone isn't entirely just him. He just he just doubles down on
it.
Yeah.
I don't think you could have continued the Christopher Columbus version of it because the characters are maturing.
Yeah.
It's not that same kind of story.
I feel like it's interesting, you know, in going to book four, how the characters melt away a little bit by way of the actors. Like, I feel like what was in the book starts being, you know, similarly for adaptation purposes, that, like, the actors have been playing it so long and had infused so much of themselves into it. It starts becoming more of the characters and less not authentic, but you get what I'm trying to say? That, like,
yeah.
you know, they stopped having Hermione have big fluffy hair and stuff like that. And, you know, what else? Like, you know, they tone back everybody wearing robes more often. And anybody else see that?
Yeah.
But also, that to a certain extent does make sense. The robes thing I kind of got because, like, I don't wear my school uniform, or I wouldn't wear my school uniform, excuse me, like, in my downtime. I'd wear, like, a t-shirt and, like, some sweatpants.
Well, it depends on the rules of the school. I'm not clear on that.
But wizards don't know how to dress in Muggles' clothes, though. So it's always been to me, I'm like, I like the look of the movies, but I'm always like, they're not supposed to be wearing that, even though, like, Hermione looks fine in that sweater, because then there's that scene from the fourth book of the old man wearing a woman's nightgown and the ministry official being like, sir, you can't wear that, but I got it at a Muggle store. It's for women. You can't be wearing that. You look out of place.
That's in the movie or the book?
No, it's
book.
Only in the book, because the movie just jumps straight into...
But that's That's that adaption to thing, right? It just doesn't, contextually in our real world, it doesn't make sense that people who literally live in a world with stores wouldn't know how to wear a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right?
I agree.
It's a great joke for Mr. Weasley, who's pretty much the only character who carries that joke through in the movies. But it doesn't have that real world texture to it.
I did find that very bizarre in the, especially in the movies, but in the books too. It's like they live right next to people, to muggles.
Oh yeah, and there's
but they have an entire department trying to understand them.
Exactly.
That Weasley works for.
I mean, there's definitely a bunch of stuff that's kind of contradictory in the books, though.
There's a few things that are a little odd, like I can understand why you would have a muggle artifacts department, like sort of like a, well, you know, there's some things that the muggles are doing that we should probably be aware of and probably keep track of, like, because we're not going to study technology the way they are, so if they invent a tank, we should probably understand how a tank works.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, and like him asking about the rubber duck is just kind of like a, come on, man, like, really? Like, you don't know what a rubber duck does?
Like, it's funny and everything.
Yeah, but it's also like, and also, I'm going to say this, like, and I think this has been brought up a few times, like, there's only one time, if memory serves, that a gun is ever brought up, and it's like when they say that Sirius Black has escaped from prison and stolen a muggle wand called a gun, and I'm like, guys, why has no one thought, just shoot somebody? Like, I mean,
well,
like,
yeah, that's just like a major plot hole of the whole series, that if you incorporate that, it'll just ruin it. It's just like, how does Mr. Weasley know how to drive a car, but he can't use a phone? Also, where did they even get a phone to make a phone call to the Dursley's house in the second book anyway?
Yeah.
So, it's just,
I imagine there's like a converter.
I guess, but what are they calling through the flu network?
I don't know. You talk into your wand. There's like it is a conversion.
You know,
spell.
It's just there are so many things that are done purposely just to make the plot move along in a way that the author wants the plot to move along. But it is, when you sit back and you look at it, you're just like, how is they have cars from the Ministry? Just, you could run over Voldemort.
But that's the same with any story.
Yeah, but
you know?
It's just like,
he'll just apparate out of the way.
Or fly.
Or fly. Yeah, according to movie 7 part 2, he can fly.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. Well, I thought he could fly in the books. Wasn't only him and Snape that learned how to fly without a broom? Or knew how to fly without a broom?
No, there's never anything in the books about any of them knowing how to, like, fly without a broom.
No, Snape definitely could fly without a broom. I thought that was a thing.
In the books.
He just disapparates, or I don't know.
Ah, okay.
He go floop, floop,
man,
floop.
I would have bet money on this, but I'm wrong.
Teleportation is superior to flight.
Yeah, that's pretty true.
But flight's more fun.
I think it's impressive, and part of the magic of Harry Potter, that there are all these weird inconsistencies and plot holes, but they don't subtract from your enjoyment.
No, not at all.
Actually, discussing them adds to your enjoyment,
and
I think.
Some of it was intentional. So I don't know. One thing that I didn't notice until recently when I listened to the audiobooks again sometime last year, J.K. Rowling uses inches very frequently and like just very odd assortments of measurements in the Wizarding world, where the books take place in the UK and they use the metric system, but wands are 13 and a half inches and let's measure the width between your eyes to figure out what size wand you need.
A lot of that stuff comes from, I mean, the British people use pounds, like not like the money, but like, you know, the weight.
Yeah.
And, you know, stone and stuff, because our measurements came from them in the imperial sense. And I think that actually grew from the fact that they were removed from scientific society and thus came from imperial Europe,
it would
stuff.
Make sense given when the Wizarding
thought.
World branches off from Muggle world.
Interesting.
They probably would have still been using pounds.
Huh. But yeah, I'm agreeing with Michelle on this. Like, some of the inconsistencies just add to it. Like, there's like even one of the most blaring ones. Like, I remember in the films, like, they forgot to mention about how Harry gets a piece of that mirror, or how it's relevant. But like, you don't care. Like, it's fine. You pick up and you go. Like, whatever. Harry's got a
mirror that he sees.
No. There's
the mirror that he sees Dumbledore's brother in.
Yeah,
he broke that in the fifth book, and it stayed.
No.
With
in
Trump.
The film, they never get into that.
Yeah, no, they don't really explain it in the movies that was the two-way mirror that Sirius gave him.
Yeah, It's just something that he has. But, like, you know what? You go along with it.
I mean, you definitely have to accept it because of the way, you know, like, books work in such a way that you can describe how somebody looks for 3 pages and literally show them for a frame and get it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, there's, like, this interaction that people have, and you go, oh, they got along great, but you need to have, like, 5 minutes of conversation and stuff like that to really cover it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I kind of wanted to talk slightly, if we have time, about Cursed Child, if people are interested.
I could.
So, do you want to talk just about Cursed Child, or do you want to talk about all the expanded
content?
We're
going to do Cursed Child, and then after that, if we're going to talk about Fantastic Beasts. But Cursed Child, I'm trying to get my timeline right. Did Cursed Child, the screenplay itself, come out before the first Fantastic Beasts movie?
Yes.
I think, yes, it did.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was a bad child, and I downloaded a PDF of it and never actually bought the screenplay and read it. So, have people read it?
I have read it, yeah.
Has anyone seen it?
No.
Oh, am I the lone wolf that's seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a grueling 6 hours, but it was very good.
Wait, 6 hours?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a two-part play.
It's two-part play. The first part is about 2.5 hours, and the second part is about 2.5 hour. So it was really 5 hours, but then you have intermissions.
Yeah.
And they do give you a dinner break. So the first part I saw, it was like at 2 o'clock, and then it goes to like 5:30, and then you go and you eat Italian food in the theater district.
Yeah.
And then you come back for the other 2.5 hours. So, do people think that Cursed Child has been a success?
I would say it's
multinational play.
Oh yes, it is.
It's been critically panned, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So it's tough. The script itself is not well received because a lot of changes that it kind of has to assume are made to Harry Potter canon to allow the events in Cursed Child to exist. But the play itself is generally revered highly when it's not in relation to the story, right?
The production's amazing.
The music is great. The acting's phenomenal.
Fantastic.
You know, they say, for most people, I said it's way better experience than reading the play, because when you're reading the play, all you get is this kind of bogus story, but going to see the play feels more immersive and more enjoyable.
I feel like it's comical in that it reads like a fan fiction, but it's hysterical because it's written by the original author.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
I thought she had supervised.
She put her name on it.
She approved it.
Oh, okay.
So two other people wrote the screenplay, and they were like, hey, JK, we have this idea to make you more money. Granted, she does donate a lot to charity. So they wrote the whole idea. She kind of guided it, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I know she has come out and said that what happens in the play is canon to the rest of the series. So when I read it, I was like, what the heck is this? This is dumb. I don't like it. And this doesn't make any sense. I was very nervous about going to see the play because I thought I was not going to enjoy it. It was gorgeous. It was so well done. But still, the story itself is kind of goofy. So,
well, time travel.
So, just as a little background for the play is written by Jack Thorne, who some people may know as he's actually the writer behind Shameless and Skins. John Tiffany, who does a lot of awards drama writing for plays in the UK. And the story outline was penned by J.K. Rowling and John Tiffany, while Jack Thorne wrote the overall dialogue and script for the play.
Oh, okay.
So there were a lot of people involved in it, but the day-to-day production of the play was handled by people who are not J.K. Rowling. But as you said, it is a J.K. Rowling-endorsed version of Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
I will say I do, even if it's problematic, I do like the time travel aspect of it. I do like them going to like, oh, what if we change this? And then coming back and things are different.
Really,
oh, my God.
It
makes
you come into, you know, don't mess with time.
Yeah.
You know. If you haven't read it, if you haven't seen it, then stop listening to me right now because I'm going to spoil it. The main event that Harry's son Albus and Draco's son,
Scorpius,
who end up becoming best friends and are both in Slytherin, and Harry's like, how could my son be a Slytherin, and why are you friends with the Malfoy boy? This is terrible. I'm angry Harry again. They're all like, you know, I don't like that my dad's famous. Let's try. What can we do? Maybe we won't let Voldemort come back, and then Harry will never defeat Voldemort, and everything will be fine. So they're like, well, let's go back to when they killed Cedric, and let's just, like, not let Cedric die. So they go back in time and manipulate with that and pretend to be Bulgarians in the crowd, because Bulgarians are very important, and they don't have accents, and they almost get caught. And they stop Cedric from getting killed. They, like, ruin his chances and humiliate him during the first task. And because of that, Cedric becomes a Death Eater.
I remember this.
Like,
now.
It's just so goofy. But it still works. Like,
I didn't realize they accepted Hufflepuffs.
I didn't either. But they took in Peter Pettigrew, and he was a Gryffindor, so.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't really discriminate, except they really did.
They just used him.
So, but the whole time while I was watching the play, has anyone here watched a Harry Potter musical?
Yes, I love a Harry Potter musical.
There were so many instances in which Draco's son Scorpius, I'm sorry, that's Draco from, I'm sorry, I'm going to pick Fox. Like, he acts the same way, and in the Harry Potter musical, which is not canon and is just a parody that is on
amazing.
YouTube. And if you haven't watched it, it's just really funny. There's an odd couple joke in it with Voldemort and Quirrell that is just very near and dear to my heart, and the songs still come on shuffle on my iTunes and I cry. Anyway, there's parts in which Draco in the parody is very obsessed with Hermione Granger and is like in love with Hermione Granger, and I'll be like, oh, that Hermione Granger, she just makes me wild. Scorpius in the play is obsessed with Rose Granger.
Oh, Lord.
Like, if I was... Who was it that produced a Harry Potter musical?
Oh, I don't know.
The company, they also did Me and My Dick.
They also did Holy
James.
Musical Batman.
Yeah, they did a lot of great things.
They did a lot of great things. Holy Musical Batman, though. Wow, that's good.
Harry Potter musical, originally titled Harry Potter the Musical, is...
Starkid Productions.
Is a Starkid Productions. Starkid comes out of the University of Michigan. It's written by Darren... the music
Chris.
Is Darren Criss and A.J. Holmes. And the book was written by Matt Lang, Nick Lang, and Brian Holden.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, Starkid Productions, if you want to sue somebody, just an idea. They stole your ideas.
I think what I like about the concept of a cursed child is it doesn't stop that concept we talked about that was very fundamentally Harry Potter with the idea of trying to grow up with the material, right? It gives us a background and a look into kind of the adult psyche of the characters. Whether that's successful or not, you know, is up for debate, but you know, to show that these characters still have growing to do, you know, after the epilogue is, you know, as we've talked about it with many other properties that continue beyond their, you know, beyond their original endpoint, is always somewhat simultaneously both entertaining and frustrating for many inherent reasons.
Well, Harry ends up needing to learn how to grow as a father in Cursed Child.
Which is a new journey for
yes.
him, as we, the generation of people that read Harry Potter, become older and have children or move into places in the workforce and things like that. Those are struggles that the cursed child attempts to deal with.
Do we feel like, because this seems to always be some of the problems he'll bring up with Cursed Child, do we feel like they focused too much, or not enough, I guess for lack of a term, on Harry? Like, was this, because this seems like you're trying to make this other character, Albus, because, Jesus, Harry cannot name children, I'm sorry. But anyway.
If he had a fourth kid, it would have been Dobby Hedwig.
We're done. Anyway. Do we feel like they should have committed to Harry or committed to Albus as far as who the protagonists were? Because you do spend a decent amount of time with the adult characters. So I'm just curious, should they have gone one way or the other, or do we feel like the balance is the right wing thing to do?
I think it was good split, because I don't think you could have had one without the other.
Yeah.
So, and I think because it was you know, a play, you're able to kind of have, you know, end scene and then move on to the new perspective. Because you even see that every so often with a chapter in the series. Usually it was like the beginning chapters, like the first chapter in book 1, 4, 6, and 7 all are a different perspective and they are not from Harry. Book 1, we see the Dursleys. Book 4, we have Frank, the gardener who's killed at the old Riddle House.
Yeah.
Book 6, we see the other minister. And book 7, or no, book 6, there's two. We see the other minister and then we also see Spinner's End, in which we get an inside look of Snape being the double agent that he is attempting to be.
Yeah.
Or is, you know, successfully doing, actually. It was pretty good. I liked that chapter very much. And then book 7, I think there's, someone correct me if I'm wrong, is there a different perspective in book 7, the first chapter, or does it just go straight into Harry world?
As a person who's never read the books, I don't know.
Doesn't book 7 start with them all meeting at his house to escape?
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Okay, so. But
where they all take the polyjuice potions and you get the Knight of the Seven Potters.
Seven Potters. And soon to be only 6.
Aww.
Sad. Rest in peace, Alistair Moody. So.
It's hardly fine. Knew ye. No, really.
No, really.
Most of the time when we got to know you, you were Doctor Who.
That's pretty accurate.
That was, David Tennant did really good in the fourth movie, I gotta say.
That tongue, so, man.
Yeah, the tongue, the flicker is but, like, ooh.
It was so a creeps. Hot second he was in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do appreciate, though, that they went so encompassing by getting, like, every English actor or British actor ever that Mad-Eye is Bill Weasley's father in real life.
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Swear to God, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's great. That's good trivia I did not know. So.
Can I transition us to the Fantastic Beasts films for a hot second? Yeah. So speaking of Doctor Who, so I'm catching the beginnings of Fantastic Beasts, and I'm looking at it. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, did you guys just really like the 11th Doctor a lot? Like, what happened here? Like, not that I dislike the ideas at play. I do like them. But definitely there's a part of me that's like, I don't know, guys. Where are we going here?
I mean,
Newt's got a case that's a TARDIS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially, right?
And a partner.
Yeah.
The fact
that... Who doesn't understand what's going on.
Exactly.
It's very Doctor Who-y. It's very Doctor Who-y.
And, you know, straight up so, Deus Ex Machina at
a
the
lot
end
of
to fix everything.
I, so far, have not personally been very impressed with the Fantastic Beasts movies. I'm also just annoyed, like, come on, get out of here, Johnny Depp. So
I don't mind Johnny Depp. Like, I understand.
Like, he's a decent cast in it, but I don't know.
I didn't like him in the film.
So,
because
then.
I actually really dug. Oh my god, I'm blanking on his name. Phone Booth. Bullseye, Daredevil. He was who Depp was pretending to be.
Oh, Colin Firth.
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell.
Yeah, I totally agree. I really liked Colin Farrell in the first film. I thought he was menacing. I thought he brought a lot to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he kind of turns out to be Johnny Depp, I'm kind of like, that's disappointing.
Yeah, I would have preferred if you just stayed Colin Farrell.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It's kind of like why?
I think there's a fundamental question we have to ask here with the Fantastic Beasts films.
Were
we interested in seeing more Harry Potter? Was this something initially when we were pitched it, post essentially The Cursed Child, were we like, this is a good idea, I want to see J.K. Rowling explore her own universe more, or were we... You know, were we already scared that J.K. Rowling would become George Lucas 2?
I'm very scared that it's turning into George Lucas 2.
Oh, she is.
Because they are planning 5 movies for this series. So the first one came out in 16. The second one came out this past winter in 18. And then it was slated that the next one was going to come out 2020, but it's been pushed back to 2021.
Well, the financial success of the last movie wasn't very good.
It wasn't. So
they may change their plans.
Yeah, that's why this other one got pushed back slightly. I think it's they're redoing some of the production to try and re-grab the thoughts of, you know, re-grab the audience back into everything.
I didn't hate the first Fantastic Beasts. You know, I like Al, I think I liked some of the ideas that were on display, but I feel like it doubles down very cheaply on the stuff from the first one into the second. You know, it just, it's just not, I didn't really need a Harry Potter prequel. I was maybe interested and could have been convinced to explore a different part of this universe, which is, I think, what kind of the initial pitch for Fantastic Beasts was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I don't necessarily need young Dumbledore as much as I like
Jude Law.
Thank you. As much as I like Jude Law, I don't know if I need young Dumbledore.
And he was only in the movie for like a hot minute.
He had a small part.
Yeah.
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 More than I thought it would be. Hmm. But I was initially, I felt pretty safe when we were told that, oh, these books aren't going to have really anything to do with the main story that we knew. You know, it's the story of the guy that wrote that one textbook that they mention a couple of times.
Where is our movie about Quidditch throughout the ages, though?
That's coming.
Just
that's,
asking.
That's going to be the next 12 movie series.
That's going to be an ESPN special, actually.
Ooh, fancy.
Like on ESPN8?
Curiosity question. How would we feel about something like that? Like as far as, like, not Quidditch throughout the ages, but what if we just played a straight, like, sports kind of, like, Cool Runnings-esque film about, like...
All the sports movies to go to. Cool Runnings?
Hey, I feel like it's appropriate.
So bobsledding isn't it?
I'm thinking
sport?
Like I'm thinking like Rudy or
yeah, like any of those movies, but like set it in the Wizarding World around Quidditch.
A Quidditch league like, of their own.
Do we feel like this could have?
There's a pretty strong women's league, I think, from like the 1400s or something like that.
Do we feel like that could work? Is that what we want to see? Something very divergent from the action fantasy narrative, and just kind of go like, let's just put a movie in this world and have it be like a sports film. Like,
ooh, or maybe like a biopic on Madame Hooch.
Ooh.
Yeah,
ooh.
I'm just curious. Is that where we wanted it to go?
Now I'm thinking about like that he brings that up, that like this meme I read about, well, if there's regular Quidditch, there's got to be like Little League Quidditch and like Squirts Quidditch, where you get like little kids who are flying 5 feet off the ground just playing Quidditch and like, you know.
I think it looks a lot like Muggle Quidditch.
Oh, probably,
ground.
Yeah. They're just running around.
You know, you're not allowed to fly. Remember how tightly supervised they were on their first flying lessons in
the
first Harry Potter
movie? Yeah, that was
movie.
Like the first time a bunch of them had flown.
Yeah.
They weren't supervised. She walked away.
Because the kid broke his arm.
Well, I mean, okay, she gave lip service to really tight supervision. Have any of you seen Wizard People, Dear Reader?
No.
Or listen to Wizard People, Dear Reader?
No, I have not.
This is an amazing thing. I believe it started out as a essentially an alternative audiobook, but if you look online, you can find it synced up to the original movie. But Brad Neely, the guy behind China, Illinois on Adult Swim.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Did a one-man reading, a reinterpretation of The Sorcerer's Stone.
Oh, this looks amazing. I'm on the wiki.
It's amazing. Frank introduced me to this. It's hilarious.
What's it called again?
Wizard People, Dear Reader.
Oh, okay. And you watch it along, and you listen to it alongside the film?
Yeah, you can actually find it online, synced up.
Oh, okay.
You get the video file.
I'm interested.
But yeah, I mean, when we talk about a beast lumbering out of the sky like a giant hairy truck aboard his Sky Panther, is Hagar the Horrible.
Oh, all right, God. That sounds pretty good.
It's absolutely amazing.
So, curiosity question, going back to our sources. As we've talked about how these the original series has gotten so many parodies and reinterpretations. We have Harry Potter musical. We have this thing that Pete just brought up.
Plus.
And we're talking about these sequels, like how Fantastic Beasts is struggling right now. What do we feel didn't work that worked with Harry Potter? Like, what fell off? What happened? What happened?
I blame everything on Ilvermorny. Ilvermorny is the American Wizarding School. And as I have mentioned in the production meetings here, Ilvermorny is a garbage school for losers.
I just feel like there's too much of a push. I feel like we were really forced to want to see these movies. I don't really think it was something anyone really asked for. It Not that.
I don't think anybody said, I want to see Harry Potter, but in the 20s.
Yeah. Like, I liked the first movie a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was kind of, it could have been like a one-and-done little spinoff, and everyone would have gone home happy. The second movie, I struggled through so much. It didn't help that I was really tired when I went to the movies and didn't plan to go see it, but I almost fell asleep.
Plus, there was that whole racism fiasco that they were talking about.
Yeah.
That really didn't give the movie much great press.
I think all of the things we talked about what made Harry Potter work aren't present.
Yes.
Unfortunately, because these movies have to balance the idea that they want to both introduce a new audience and retain the old audience, they can't grow, right? We can't get a G-rated kids film, right,
mm-hmm.
That we're going to be super interested in going to see. But they can't do, you know, Harry Potter Deadpool, because that also alienates their
Although
audience.
I want that now.
I'd be into that.
Now that you've said it.
Seventh book.
You know, so there's no ability for it to grow with it. There's so much, I don't want to say there's so much less to latch onto with a movie, because Pope, you and I are obviously very involved in movies and film, a lot of us here love the medium, but there is something inherently different about the written word and the medium of film, and they play to strengths differently. And I just don't know if Fantastic Beasts is ever intentionally playing to the strengths that films have, as compared to try and recapture book magic with film motifs.
Well, I also feel like it was literally just these problems of a lot of movies, film, shows, everything like that, that get too bogged down with, like, the people up top in advertising, where they, like, throw things in because they're like, oh, this will work, you know. Oh, people love Dumbledore, let's put him in the movie. Oh, people love this, let's have that. Oh, Nagini's a, you know, familiar character, let's throw her in there. It's just like, there's a lot of, like, oh, these are familiar aspects without, like, knowing a way really to tie them all together that, you know, really probably ruin the experience for people, or at the very least just didn't get them excited to watch it, because it didn't matter if it was a good or bad movie. If you want to watch it, that's all they care about, money, money, money.
I'll also say they didn't give us a chance to miss it. I don't feel like enough time had really passed before we were like, oh, is more Potter stuff? I thought we were done.
Yeah.
What happened?
Last movie came out in, what, 2011?
It's 2011, 12? Yeah.
2011, and then 5 years later we have Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah, Harry Potter never had the ability to fade from the popular cultural zeitgeist, and for intentional reasons. Scholastic and the British Publishing Company and J.K. Rowling were keeping that going with mm-hmm. things like Pottermore and the textbooks mm-hmm. and, you know,
the graphic novels.
Admittedly, this stuff was more fun and a little bit smaller scale than movies. But obviously, Warner Brothers, right, the company that now is partnered with and owns a part of the visual aspect of the Wizarding World, you know, they want to cash in on that too. And I just don't think J.K. Rowling also never gave herself a chance to come up with the next new idea. Say what you will about the prequels of Star Wars being bad, but there's a ton of interesting ideas in there.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Tons of them.
And there was also 20 years in between?
Exactly. Lucas had plenty of time to think up really cool and interesting ideas to throw into movies. He didn't think up a good story to go in between them. But, you know, Rowling didn't have a lot of time to do that, particularly while it was almost insisted by the people she worked with that she continues to, you know, release new factoids and keep people involved in this world. That's where we get to the point where we're learning that wizards just defecated wherever they walked and then evaporated or whatever their, you know, crap behind them. It just...
Did we ever establish where it goes?
No.
No, we
nope,
don't.
It's
let's
never
not.
Known.
No.
And we don't know if that little mouse that got turned into a teacup ever goes back to being a mouse.
But there's you know, a sense of wonder and a sense of non-explanation that sometimes makes things better, right? Darth Vader was cool because we didn't really know where he came from. You know, it's nice to know the Dumbledore we know now, right? The Dumbledore that maybe was maybe always had Harry's best intentions in mind, or, you know, maybe was a little manipulative. I don't want a defined answer on that. I don't want to see him manipulating professors and other people back in the day, right? Sometimes more explanation doesn't add to it, you know? And I think some distance from Harry Potter and from its established canon is good.
Yeah, and I'll even say, like, Dumbledore to me was always – I thought he was just always that old guy. Like, to go back in the 20s, like, and see him young, it's like, wait, he was young? Like, that's weird to me in a bizarre way, because it's like, I don't even feel like he should have been that young at that point. I think he should have still been, like, some cadre old dude.
Yeah, good wizards, you don't know how
he
long
was,
he could have
like,
lived.
He was 90-something at death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because...
Is that all?
Yeah. Yeah, he was... Maybe he might have been it older, was? But even then, if you do the math of, like, 1980s is... Or 19... What year does Harry start school?
1991?
No, 91. 91. He starts school in 91, and Dumbledore is dead
like,
in...
Like 120-something, I thought.
Okay, so even then. So do the math. 1920s to 1990s, 70 years. He should still be like 50-something.
Yeah. Yeah. He shouldn't be Jude Law.
No.
Yeah.
So, there's, and I understand why.
He's 115 at death.
Okay.
Then he really shouldn't be Jude Law.
No.
There's also a problem the Harry Potter series or Rowling has... kind of had with post-work representation. So, you know, yeah, it's cool that you announced that Dumbledore was gay, I guess, but you don't own it in the books. It's cool that you announced this thing and this thing are inclusive, but you never included that in the thing that made you famous, that became so popular, that would have then popularized these themes to some extent in the zeitgeist. You know, it's cool, don't get me wrong. But it's not particularly helpful. And then to have movies come out and then say, like, oh, well, we're not going to explore that because it's too controversial. This is literally the only reason I would have wanted to see Dumbledore and Johnny Depp's Grindelwald's character exist in the same place on screen. So to hash that out. We got to hash
that
out.
See that romance. But that's also one of, like, the critiques that J.K. Rowling has gotten is... forced inclusiveness, in which it's like you just said, oh, okay, well, she announces this thing post the books coming out, but you never really see it, and it's just, okay, Dumbledore is a man that never married and had a family. That doesn't just, I don't know, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
What I'm saying?
It essentially, that post-inclusiveness essentially just... informed a stereotype that
yes.
we have of
yes,
men that never married,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it's...
So, and you don't see any other, like, same-sex relationships throughout the series.
Not one, even though it's obviously a large school with a lot of kids who there had to have been some kids that were, you know, gay, bisexual, lesbian, genderqueer, whatever.
It's odd, but at the same time, like... Like, you can't get credit for it afterwards, I don't think. I don't think
that's my thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not here to bash the book should have been more inclusive from the get-go.
Right.
They're published in the 90s. They're very indicative of the media at the time. And they've done a lot of things for a lot of people in all different areas and walks of life.
Yeah.
Right? So that's great. It's just the reverse, you know, it's the reversal on it. The trying to take credit after the fact.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. It's tough. It's tough because, like, we want to believe that the creators of these things, like, don't, like, hold a lot of the same timelessness as the work that they create. And unfortunately, they are but mortal people, and they can eventually fail or become victims of their own ego or, you know, any number of things.
I feel like there's a certain element of ambiguity going through the books, you know, in that, you know, that she never outright says anything about Dumbledore's sexuality. And, you know, like, going through, I feel like that helps a lot with the relation to characters, because I've noticed going back through the books, there's literally zero mention of Hermione's skin color, which, mm-hmm. you know, played into the play, into Kerschild, that, you know, that when they cast the black, I don't remember the actress's name from the original, but, you know, her being black caused a lot of controversy, and then they go, and she went back and she's like, where did I say she was white? You know, it was a girl with bushy hair.
But then we also see very specific characters that are identified by their race. So, like, Dean Thomas is the one black kid that's in Gryffindor, Blaze Zambini, the Slytherin, who's introduced in book 6, is identified as being a black character, and then Cho Chang is identified as being an Asian character. Solely
I thought she was Welsh.
She is. You can be.
Or Irish.
So.
Yeah, her comment about that infuriated me, because it's like she was trying to use her normality of white skin color to like, well, I didn't say, like, don't take credit for that. Just say, like, no, I think it's fine. I think it's good. Like, I just, to try and make this hint at your own, like, progressiveness, I think is just.
And I think that's the problem, is we don't know intent. And I think it kind of brings the subject back around to, you know, and we've had this conversation many times before in some form, but the ownership of work, right? Who owns works that become so public and so amassed and so loved? Is it the audience who then goes on to interpret it in millions of ways? Is it the big companies that inform the work who possibly, you know, told J.K. Rowling to leave out this thing, or, hey, J.K. Rowling, you're going to be involved in these other sequels and spin-offs we're going to do? Or is it the author themselves?
And, you know, I feel like the fact that we can get mad about things like this also speaks to how much we all love this, how really we appreciate this series, you know, kind of tying this all together, that we are here to talk about, I guess, how, why, where this brought us all.
Nobody has impassioned conversations about things they didn't enjoy.
Like dung beetles.
Or,
I mean, someone's
I can talk
into,
a lot about someone, dung beetles.
Someone's definitely into dung beetles.
If you are, call me.
We're not here to judge your thing. We're just saying that it's not our thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it goes back to something we were even talking about way back when we did the Ava rewatch. Is it's just about how, about legacy, and how it creates this sort of huge thing around it. Like Star Wars and other things like it. And it's just, it's crazy to think about, like, where it all came from and how it started. And, yeah.
Can I help wrap us up, Michelle?
Oh, yes, you can.
Let's go around and say, like, our one favorite Harry Potter moment. It could be something from the movies, from the books, a personal fan experience, just something to bring us back and end on the rose instead of the thorn.
Do you want to start?
Oh, gosh. Now you're putting me on the spot.
I can start. I already know my thing. I didn't even come up with this idea thread, but I got my movie 6, Sassy Harry, is my favorite thing to come out of the movie franchise. He's got pinchers. Sorry, but that was just Daniel Radcliffe's acting in the 6th movie was really well done. So he was not exactly my favorite actor or even who I would have chosen, but he really grew into the role, and I think all of the characters really grew into the role that they were playing, which was nice to see.
Yeah. I'm going to go really off book here, and I'm going to say, like, my favorite Harry Potter moment has got to be, like, a Harry Potter sequel. And it's got to be Umbridge and just screaming about eating falcon eggs and rocks. Like, I just think that it's just the greatest thing in the world. Those musicals, they're so good and they're so vibrant, and something about them is just amazing. And, like, taking that source material and making, like, that's how great Harry Potter was, though, or is now, that you could parody it, grab some of that greatness. There was so much of it there that just, like, a snippet of it, like, made so much, like, out of it. Like, it's crazy to me that just, like how much you could get out of that franchise. How much you could, like, and we haven't seen, it's like Star Wars, really.
Yeah, I think, it for me, it's really how the universe has grown. I went down to Universal and got to ride the Hogwarts Express between the two parks, and it was just so much fun being immersed that much. Although, at the same time, I'd probably love, you know, the naked Dumbledore puppet.
Oh, man, Harry Potter puppet pals.
Puppet pals. I love Luna Lovegood.
Yeah.
Everything about her, except her dad. Scumbag.
Yeah, what a dirtbag.
Seriously, man.
All it's of like, my things go missing.
Don't worry, they always find their way back.
Just literally love everything about her. I can't. Yeah, I got nothing else to say. I can't specify anything.
I also, like, canonically, she kind of grows out of her father's, like neglect and stupidity, for lack of a better term. like, oh, all this stuff that you write about is probably fake. I'm not going to believe it anymore. Bye, Dad. You go, Luna. Hell yeah.
I think for me, I'm going to say John Williams' score. We don't have a ton of... You know, I can only think of a few movie scores that feel so transcendent. But John Williams...
Wrote all of them.
Well, no, he wrote the music for the first three films.
Oh, I just meant, but no, he meant all of the universe-creating things.
Exactly.
He wrote all of those.
To be able to get one last sort of... You know, and I know he's doing Star Wars right now, but they're all kind of derivative of the stuff he's done before. To get something that felt newly wholly new and original for a new thing, it just, you know, if any other composer had handled it.
And he nailed it.
Yeah, that leitmotif from like the... It's like as up there with like, you know, the Star Wars theme where it really just draws you into the universe.
Yeah, it's... You know it. Immediately you hear it and you think Harry Potter. And, I mean, what a gift.
And you did that the moment you first heard it, too.
Mm, yeah, absolutely.
Like, that came on and you're like, this is what Harry Potter sounds like.
Yep.
This is Harry Potter music. This
yeah,
is,
oh
this
my
is
God, right? Oof.
That is something else. That's an incredible gift to have.
So, thank you, everyone, for joining us on our magical adventuring into the wizarding world.
If you'd like to hear more of us talk about the wizarding world or other things that happened last week in Geek, please like, subscribe, follow, etc.
Comment. Make your voices heard.
Give us money on Patreon.
Or subscribe to us on any of your podcatcher apps, you know.
Tell us you want more of this and we'll make more.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we could talk about this for weeks.
Last Week in Geek, a series where we revisit some of the best things in geek culture. Join us again next time.
Good night, everybody!
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.